couple of weeks ago was when that festival happened, and Tyrion and I had a really great experience there. And I want to say this morning as well, in the interest of honest reporting, that the Winnipeg Folk Festival remains the best organized and most impressive festival I've attended. But as I've already said, I have to also honestly say that what I experienced at that Edmonton Festival, like, blew me away a bunch of times. Just amazing. I've been kind of going on about this ever since I got back, so if I'm starting to bore you, let me know. But I'll have more stories from this event, because there's just a bunch of things that are kind of seared into me over the course of that weekend. One of the recurring themes at that festival was hearing performers who live in the U.S. talk about what it was like to be in Canada. And that's a pretty generic thing to do from the stage, right? I mean, it's just kind of good performer behavior. If you're traveling and you're in another country and it's a good experience, you say that. It's great to be here in Canada. It's great to be here in Edmonton, you know, whatever, right? You kind of do that thing. So there was lots of that. But the context was, without exception, that of the American artist saying some version of "my country is in trouble" to the Canadian audience. And most of the time, it wasn't partisan political diatribes. It was just kind of this blanket acknowledgement that the whole thing is a mess. And I found it both, when I thought back on what's going on for me emotionally when I hear this over and over again, that I was experiencing both sadness about that, but I was also sort of encountering it as ironic to hear those kind of sentiments coming from people whose leadership has been so outspoken about how successful they are being at restoring the American dream to its former luster. And don't get me started on what was deeply wrong with the dream in the good old days. We're just going to stay on topic. One of the artists that I got to see there was a guy named Jason Isbell. Isbell and their band, they're touring in Canada right now. He's from the States, based in Nashville, I think, at this point. He was just here in Winnipeg a couple of weeks ago at the concert hall. One of the songs that Isbell played in their set was a song about living in a white man's world, and he prefaced that song by talking about how when he does this song in the U.S., he's often reminded afresh, because of people's reaction to it, that there are, quote, in his words, a lot of angry white people out there who don't want to hear what's problematic about the dream of white or colonial superiority, never mind white supremacy, which is a movement that's been all over the Winnipeg media this week, because, as it turns out, there's no one's backyard that's exempt from hate. When Isbell was here in Winnipeg, their opening act was a singer-songwriter named Josh Ritter, who happens to be one of my favorite American singer-songwriters. Corrine and I had tickets to go see this together, and then subsequent to purchasing those tickets, Tyrion and I decided to go to the folk festival where Isbell was also playing, so it was like, that's kind of redundant, so gave my ticket away to a friend of Corrine's, and they went together. But Ritter is somebody that I encountered for the first time at the Winnipeg Folk Festival. Another white guy from the heartland of America, an artist that like lots of singer-songwriters who tend to be kind of reflective, is a person that sees in many parts of their contemporary culture the erosion of a good dream rather than the restoration of a good dream, which is kind of interesting. I want to play you the official music video from one of the tunes on Ritter's current album. The album is called The Fever Breaks, and the song is called All Some Kind of Dream, and then we'll come back to this after we watch and listen to this together. If you grew up around the Bible at all, like, you can't miss the proliferation of biblical references in Ritter's song. Saw my brother in a stranger's face, I saw my sister in a smile, my mother's laughter in a far-off place, my father's footsteps in each mile. I thought I knew who my neighbor was, we didn't need to be redeemed. Oh, what could I have been thinking of? Was it all some kind of dream? Right out of the chute, who is my neighbor, right? Which is basically the question that launches Jesus' still famous story about the Good Samaritan, which is another way of asking the question. The person who asks Jesus that question is actually asking, whose suffering is my concern? And that's the question that Jesus tells a racial story about an answer, among other things, racial and religious. Second stanza, I saw my country in the hungry eyes, and then just goes through all these different images in that verse about how the experience that we see in other people is actually a common human experience, even if it's not the one we're living in. And then the third verse talking about the holding pens that, you know, we're familiar with from the media. And then in the fourth verse, I saw justice with a tattered hem. I saw compassion on the run, but I saw dignity in spite of them. I prayed its day would finally come. There was a time when we chose sides and we refused to live between. We rose to fight for what we knew was right, or was it all some kind of dream? So not slamming back and forth like we talked about this morning. In that second verse, there was a time when we were them, when we took them in. Was there an hour when we took them in? Again, a reference to Jesus' teaching that when you've done it unto one of the least of these, you've done it unto me, which is Jesus' way of saying that God is in everyone. And when we care for one another, we actually care for God. And I find it especially intriguing that as a Josh Ritter fan, this is Ritter's 10th album, he's been at this for a while, it's obvious from his body of work that he's a person who grew up surrounded by Christian fundamentalism and has thoughtfully and quite thoroughly rejected it. But he's also an art maker who had a career as a novelist before they became a working musician, and he knows the power of good language, and he knows the power of literary images and of stories, and in the final event, Ritter is a storyteller. And as a storyteller, he knows something that's essential about stories. He knows how important it is to both root the stories he's telling in the past, in this case in the teachings of Jesus, in the ancient past, you could contend. So he knows how important it is to both root his stories in the past, and he knows how important it is to not leave them there, but to have their truths evolve so that they can inform our dreams about the future. So this is a thing that he just does brilliantly in this song, right? References the teachings of somebody who lived 2,000 years ago and sets them right into current events and current politics and current fears and concerns, right? It's brilliant business with that. So one of the things that Ritter makes clear in a piece of art like this is that for stories to stay lively, for stories to continue to have power in our lives and in the world, they need to not just age. They'll just do that naturally. They need to unfold over time. They need to open over time, not close. And that's true for any sort of story, including our religious stories and our spiritual stories, the stories that provide a compass for how we believe and for how we live. Those stories need to unfold if they're going to continue to be dynamic in the world. And that, of course, is not a new idea. I want to give you an example from sacred text, starting with a Hebrew text. I think it's kind of funny that in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Christian studies of the Hebrew scriptures, we group the prophets. There's some collections of writings that are regarded as prophetic, and we group them into the major prophets and the minor prophets, sort of the farm team and the big leagues. I want to reference a minor prophet this morning. This is from the book of Joel, and like is often the case, the prophetic writings are addressed to a nation, to the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, and their dream of what a good life is in a shambles. And that's the case in Joel. And Joel's take on why things are in shambles is that this is the judgment of God. Joel's God is seriously angry. Really, really unhappy deity. From Joel's perspective. And one of the results, again, Joel's perspective, is that when God is angry, what God does is deal out punishment, devastation. They disassemble good dreams. They just shatter them. But Joel's God is also on about the restoration of people who see in that shambles a reason to return to God. So that's kind of the picture of the deity that Joel has. Anyway, it's categorically the business of prophets to see what's wrong. Like, that's their job. It's an essential part of why they exist in these kind of stories. They don't always get called prophets, of course. Different traditions call those voices by different names. Sometimes they're sages, sometimes they're elders, sometimes they're gurus. But whatever name we give them in cultural history, they have this perspective. They have this unique ability to point to what isn't working, to point to what's broken, to point to what's shattered, to point to what's in disarray. And sometimes they also contribute a course correction or another perspective on those things and say, here's a way to pull out of the dive. Here's a path forward when you feel like there's no path forward. So Joel goes on at length in the book of Joel about some pretty horrific things and calls the collection of those horrific things, we were talking about this morning a little bit, Tracy, calls them the Day of the Lord, which sort of launches this phrase into sacred text, Hebrew sacred text and subsequently Christian sacred text, in a way that turns out to be this kind of collective phrase for everything's going to hell in a handbasket and God's responsible, but you can fix it if you come back, right? So the Day of the Lord ends up being this kind of apocalyptic phrase in the literature. And Joel's the writer that, in the canon of scripture that Christianity calls the Bible, Joel's the writer that launches that phrase. And then says, after all these awful things will come a restoration. Now, here's another bold thing that prophets do. They don't just see what's wrong. That's sort of the core of their function in a lot of ways, is to point out the problem. But they speak for the divine in first person. That's crazy. But this is what they do. They do it all the time. They say things like, God says, and then they say stuff in, you know, quotation marks. Like they're quoting from an interview with God. Right, where they sat down face to face with the divine said stuff, they wrote it down, and then they took it to the people. Said, when I was chatting with God, this is what God said. So the prophets do that kind of thing all the time. Now, it's kind of powerful when they do that and they turn out to be right. It's kind of confusing when they do that and they turn out to be wrong. But either way, there is something kind of compelling about the level of conviction in it all, about the robustness of their belief in all of this, right? So Joel, or whoever's writing, because we actually don't have a clue who wrote the book of Joel. Only thing we know about who wrote it is whatever is claimed internally by the book itself. We have almost no other information. Literary point of view, it looks like probably three or four writers edited over time, etc., etc. Anyway, I'm just going to refer to the writer as Joel. So when the writer or writers gets to this part of the story that I'm going to reference, they do this. They switch to quoting God, first person. And this is a text we find. This is in Joel 2:28. So this is the prophet quoting and saying, God says, okay, so that's the status of these words. So God says, afterward, after all this devastation, all of this loss of hope, all of this tattered life experience, afterward, I will pour out my spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my spirit in those days. So what I want to do this morning is come back to this evolving story idea. You got to remember that this text originated somewhere between the 9th and 3rd century BCE. So this is old, okay? Anywhere in there, the case would have been that it was written to a culture that was patriarchal, that regarded women as property and slaves as subhuman property. And that could be reason enough from a contemporary perspective to just be dismissive about its contemporary relevance. We could just throw it out in dismay about that. But stay with me for a minute, because the prophet suggests that the presence of God, the presence of the divine, results in restoration. One sign of which, according to Joel, is this renewed welling up of dreams about a good future. And one of the signs that the divine is present in this story is that the people who are dreaming these dreams are not only the old men, patriarchal culture, so those would be the power holders. The dreamers of the good dreams are not only the old men, they are also the young men. So far, so good, sticking with the patriarchal theme, and the young women. And, hold everything, the slaves. What? When Joel says, God says, and then says this to people who listen to them as though they're quoting from an interview with God, and says something like this, they are taking the story of what constitutes a good society into an entirely new space. But they are doing it in a way that references the idea that the power behind all that is good is beyond ancient. That the power that is behind all that is good is actually the same power that put everything into motion in the first place, and the sort of power for which, when we're draping images on, you know, the unimaginable, we use God language. It's fascinating. So one way to read that story from Joel is like this. When you see fresh dreams about a good world bubbling up, when you see entire groups of people that have been sidelined and suppressed and dismissed giving voice to those good dreams, you know that you are in the presence of the sort of restoration that is fueled by that for which we use God language, by the divine, by Creator, by God, by Spirit, by grace, and so on. And here's the part about how that idea has traveled over time and unfolded, just really briefly. So Acts, now we're in the Christian sacred text, we're in the New Testament. The book of Acts is a fascinating kind of micro history of a bunch of people trying to figure out what to do with the character and the teachings of Jesus. And so it's sort of the unfolding, the early unfolding of the religion we now think of as Christianity. And in the middle of that chapter, chapter 2, there's this story about the day of Pentecost, this when something spiritual happens in a way that an entire wider community who wasn't looking for it, as well as a community that was, is struck by it and moved by it in some way. They don't know what to make of it, and they start to kind of sift that through right there in the story. So this is what's going on. So in Acts chapter 2, when there's this spiritual movement, whatever happens, the way the storyteller gives it to us is that a bunch of people were in Jerusalem, and they were suddenly hearing people who didn't know their culture and their language and their religion talk to them about the divine in a way that they understood, which shouldn't have been possible. And they're kind of floored by it. They don't know what to make of it. Some people are like, these folks are drunk, which seems like a weird explanation for, I can understand you better than I should be able to. Peter's response is, they can't be drunk. It's only 9 in the morning. Whenever I read that, I kind of chuckle and think, clearly Peter was not a serious drinker. Or he'd know that 9 in the morning's fine. You know, if you've been drinking all night, you're going to be tanked by 9. Anyway, that's sort of the response. And his explanation is this is about spirit. And this is about the presence of God. And when Peter's trying to explain all of this, he's trying to explain how a bunch of people, this cosmopolitan group of people, are having this experience where they're like, I thought I knew what size box God fit in. This does not match that. I don't know how to explain this experience I'm having. When Peter's trying to explain the experience that this cosmopolitan group of people are having with an encounter with the divine, he quotes Joel. So he uses the text that we looked at from this minor prophet way back when, centuries before, to answer the question, what's going on here spiritually? So in essence, he says, this is what Joel is talking about. What Joel is talking about way back then was the presence of the divine in us and among us, all of us. Because what precedes Peter's explanation and quoting Joel is a list of where the people that are in the city of Jerusalem and having this experience together are from. And they are from all over the known world. It's like a representative list of everyone. That's who's there. And everyone's having this experience. And when Peter goes to explain the experience, the way he explains it is by saying, yep, that's right. This is who God is for. Which, from a Jewish person, would have been unimaginable. Absolutely unimaginable. Now, Peter goes on to set that narrative into the Jewish narrative of a Messiah, unquestionably. And a little while later in the Acts story, that gets the leaders of the Christian church into a major dust-up about whether that's how they're going to proceed or not. It's also an interesting story. But this is all part of how the dream has evolved. So in terms of biblical texts, where that takes us, if we kind of keep tracking it along, is it brings us to the writings of Paul. So now we're kind of past the point where the Christian religious movement is going, oh, maybe this story isn't just for the Jews. Maybe this story is actually for all people. And they start trying to figure that out and put it into practice. Paul starts traveling and telling this story to communities of people that aren't Jewish. They start to form Christian communities. And they're starting to kind of go, well, wait a minute, how does this work if we don't have the practice of the religious community that launched this whole thing? And the way Paul answers that, is this really for everyone question, is by saying, yes. What happened, what Peter was talking about way back there in Acts, about the presence of the divine being for all people, absolutely. In the presence of this power, there is neither, Paul says, Jew nor Gentile, that's everyone, slave nor free, that's about cultural strata, status within the culture, nor is there male or female. So this isn't even about gender. This isn't about patriarchy. In other words, when it comes to what happens when we pay attention to the goodness of God, when we lean into that goodness and that presence, when we lean into the dream that humans love and care for one another without exception, what happens is that we enter a space where love supersedes things like conventional boundaries of country or culture or language. It's bigger and better, that space that I'm just trying to describe and did poorly, I think, but was trying to gesture toward. That space is bigger and better than any particular understanding of race or gender or socioeconomic status or any of the other ways we measure value in one another as human beings that is exclusionary. When it comes to being embraced by divine, if we wanted to sort of translate what Paul is saying, there is no superior religion. There is no rich or poor. There is no gay or straight. Like, just the categories we put one another in as humans do not apply. The divine presence, love, supersedes all of those things. What we make when we drape religion onto the bones of that reality is we make a particular shape that we can get a grip on because that's the thing we need, but that's not a thing the divine needs. We do that for ourselves. Which brings me back, I mean, that was 2,000 years ago, right? It's pretty progressive. Brings me back to Ritter's song for a minute, and that's where I'm going to leave this. I saw justice with a tattered hem. I saw compassion on the run, but I saw dignity in spite of them. I prayed its day would finally come. There was a time when we chose our sides and we refused to live between. We rose to fight for what we knew was right, or was it all some kind of dream? And Ritter has just spent the previous verses of the song defining a good dream of how we would treat one another by reference after reference to the teachings of Jesus, the same teachings that the texts we've been talking about point to as a way of living into a good dream, one in which all people get to walk in the goodness of God in their own language, in their own culture, in their own stories. And can you see the trajectory of that idea over time, just from those instances? I think we can. Can we imagine that kind of evolving idea in our own experience, our own dreams of the future? I hope we can. I hope we can. And at least from my perspective, that sounds like a good dream. Peace.